Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. I'm very pleased to have as my guest today Shane Free, the director of Hex Hollow, Witchcraft and Murder in Pennsylvania. It's a wonderful documentary, and I appreciate your time tremendously. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me, Eric. I appreciate it.
So where did you first hear about this story, and how did you come to make a film about it?
Well, you know, it's a story that was kind of where I grew up in New York, Pennsylvania. It's a story that really has permeated the society throughout the years. It's always kind of hung on and people have always talked about it from when it happened in 1928. So I just remember growing up and my dad would tell me this story because we lived about 25 minutes away from where it happened. So I just remember him telling me this story, and it was something that just really always kind of stuck in my mind. And I remember probably about in 2013 or so, I was thinking about the story again, and I wanted to just watch a movie about it to kind of learn more. So I thought, well, I'm going to just watch a documentary on it. There must be one made. And as I was searching around, I couldn't find anything about it other than a few books, which I've already read. So I thought, well, I guess in order to watch a documentary on this movie, I'm going to have to make one myself. So that's kind of how I really got into making it. It intrigued me how no one really touched it. And I thought it was something that needed to be kind of, you know, captured on film and just immortalized that way.
So when you began your research, what were the primary sources you used to build your story?
My main primary source was J. Ross McGinnis, who wrote kind of the definitive book on the subject. I thought, if I can get him on board, I can do this. If I can't get him on board, it really wouldn't be worth trying to do, because he's been giving speeches on this topic for like 40 years now, and he's in his 80s now. So once I got him on board, I was able to then kind of connect to other people who were related to people who were involved in the case from that point forward. So I was able to talk to family members and descendants and as many people as I could find who were still alive that were connected to this case in some way. I mean, it happened in 1928, so obviously I was lacking people directly connected, but I had descendants and I had a few people who were directly connected. So it was pretty helpful. Once I had him on board, I could kind of tell them that, look, he's going to do this with me, and that kind of gave some legitimacy to the project.
Can you talk a little bit about the Remeyer clan in Pennsylvania? What drew the family there?
Yeah, so the Remeyers, they came over from Germany, and they went in through Baltimore, and they came up into Remeyer's Hollow, the area known as Remeyer's Hollow. As far as like how they established themselves there, I mean, it was just an area that they first came into that had a lot of land that they could work with because they were farmers. So they kind of got in that way and developed and planted their family there. And when they planted their family there, all the other Rehmeyers kind of grew from that point.
Let's talk about Nelson Rehmeyer. Who was he? What was his background? And what did he do for a living?
So Nelson Rehmeyer was a farmer. That was his primary source of income. He was he grew all sorts of crops, and then he would basically take those crops up to the local farmer's market and sell them there. Kind of a recluse. He didn't really associate with many people. He had a wife and two kids. But on the side of being a farmer, he also dabbled in powwow. Powwow was a source of a form of folk medicine. And it was basically, think of it as homeopathic medicine, what people do today. So it was a book that he had called The Long Lost Friend, which was kind of like a book that would tell him how to cure people of their ills or cure their livestock or help their crops grow. Kind of things you could do in the home that could potentially affect people in a positive way. So let's say you needed a wart removed on your hand. One of the things they would do was they would take a penny and spit on the penny and put the penny on the wart. And in a few days, the wart would disappear. Kind of strange, like things like that. That people really believed in. And he was very versed in all these kind of things. So people would go to his home all hours of the day, all hours of the night to kind of ask for his help in this area. And he was doing it was very innocent. He was really just trying to help people. And that's kind of what he has been known for. So while he would farm, he would also kind of do this folk medicine called powwow.
Some people in the community thought that he was a little strange, didn't they?
They did. I think they thought he was a little strange simply because he was more of an introvert. And it's funny how that, just because you're not outgoing and you're not like in the community running around, that people assume, oh, he must be a little strange. But really the fact that people thought he was a little strange was just because he decided to kind of stay in his home, not go out too much, only to the market to sell his goods. And that's kind of where that all came from. Other than that, there wasn't really much that would point to him being that strange.
Was it common for husbands and wives in this community to live separately? That struck me when watching your film, that Nelson Rehmeyer and his wife Alice had separate homes.
That was a little different. No, it was not common. And it was also not common that they still had a pretty good relationship. But the fact was, she was just uncomfortable with, you know, different people that she didn't necessarily know, all of them coming to the house at all hours of the day and night for him to do this powwow on them. You know, they had two little girls. It was kind of awkward probably for her. So she thought, well, I have a house that I inherited. I'm just going to go over there. It's over the hill. I'll stay there with the girls. You can do your thing over there. And we'll try to kind of make this work still.
Right, right. Can you give a physical description of Nelson Rehmeyer? I ask this because his size plays an important role in the story.
He was a big man. He was Nelson Rehmeyer was probably about 6'4", husky. He in his younger days he didn't have a beard in his younger days, but his older days he kind of grew this big beard. Kind of think of like a, you know, the stereotypical look of a lumberjack. Kind of that's what he looked like. A big guy. So he was kind of imposing in some ways. So that's another reason people probably thought, this guy's a little strange. I don't want to rub this guy the wrong way because he's a lot bigger than me. And, you know, I'm just unsure of this guy. So just think of a really big guy who was kind of imposing.
So you mentioned that Nelson was a powwow practitioner. Can you explain more about what powwow is? It's Christian in origin, isn't it?
Yeah, powwow is a Christian practice. So the few powwow doctors who are still practicing today, and many still do, basically told me powwow is basically a Christian practice. So people who practice powwow are kind of, you know, an instrument for God to use to help cure people. So it's not the practice itself. It's more like you're learning to use yourself as an instrument to help other people. So one of the cool things that they taught me was the headache charm, where you literally will pull a headache from someone's head. And they actually perform this in the movie where, so if you have a headache, they'll kind of say the charm that's in the book. And while they're saying the charm, they will literally with their arm, they will be kind of pulling away from the forehead of the person and literally pulling the headache away and out of the person's head. And it's these kind of things. There's a lot of things with the hands and using the hands to kind of run over people's bodies, not touch them necessarily, but kind of above the bodies and things like that. So that it's kind of like complex because there's so much to it. And we only touch a little bit of it in the movie, but I think we do it enough where you kind of get it. Another way powwow can work is you will literally write the charm down. You will put it on a piece of paper. That person will keep the piece of paper with them. And by keeping that piece of paper with them, it'll like, if it's a charm to keep you safe, that you will be kept safe because you have this charm written down on a piece of paper that you keep on you. So it's things like that. You can drink charms. In the movie, you see him write a charm down on with washable material. Back in the day, they used like a berry, and they would crush up the berry and they would put it on the end of a stick and they would write the charm on something, wash it off into a cup, and that person would drink the charm. So there's many ways a powwow can, you know, be used in order to affect someone who's ill.
The part in your film when you interviewed the guy who was a modern day powwow practitioner, it's just fascinating that this folk magic is still being practiced today.
Yeah, it is. And even back in those days, a lot of people did it. And there was like these two factions. There was like the people that were like, you know, you got to get real medical attention for your ills. You can't be messing around with powwow. You could end up hurting your children. Let's say your children need true medical attention. You're going to a powwow guy. It's like, I think you guys should rely on, it's almost kind of like the vaccine thing now, right? So these people who don't get their kids vaccinated or who do, it's that whole kind of, you have that in a sense today. So it was weird, these two factions that really separated, because a lot of people just believed in true medicine, but some people didn't believe in true medicine. And yeah, so some people still do that today. I don't think it's as prevalent as it is obviously today as it was back then, but a lot of people did it back then, which is another reason why it was strange that they gave Rehmeyer such a hard time when he was really just one of many doing it.
And you make a point in your film that while many of these powwow practices, like carrying good luck charms, are pretty far-fetched, he was also using natural medicine akin to modern-day supplements, which very likely had some curative effect.
Yeah, and you also have to think of it this way. I think some of the effect was probably mental in those patients, right? Some of the patients probably thought, well, this is helping me, so then they felt better. It's that common, like, if you think you feel better, if you think you're being helped, you're going to feel better. So I think that's a lot of powwow. I think a lot of powwow is just positive thinking and just kind of, look, a lot of these illnesses weren't that serious. I don't think people were going into him for cancers and things like that. I think it was more smaller issues. So, you know, smaller issues tend to clear up on their own anyway. So my belief is, you know, he does his thing. And over a few days, people do get better, but they were probably going to get better anyway. But maybe they got better quicker because psychologically they thought this actually helped.
So let's talk about the other major character that comes into the story, a man named John Blymeyer. Who was he and how did he meet Nelson Rehmeyer?
So John Blymeyer was kind of a down and out guy. He had not a great life. Everything kind of was unraveling in his life. At one point, he did practice powwow as well. There's a famous thing when he worked in a factory, a rabid dog came up to the factory, and Blymeyer walked up to this dog and calmed it down just by putting his hand over the dog's head, and the dog kind of calmed down and walked away, and people found that really amazing at the time. So he himself did dabble in powwow also. And at one point, he actually did some work for Rehmeyer. Not a lot of the work, but he did work on Rehmeyer's farm briefly. I didn't really get into that in the documentary because there's not a lot of proof of that. But supposedly he did know Rehmeyer from a previous working relationship. So what was going on with Blymeyer was one of his young daughters died on birth and his wife left him. He was having trouble getting work. And things were just spiraling kind of out of control. So he himself went to a noted powwow doctor named Nellie Knoll. And she was kind of known as the Witch of Marietta. Marietta is another town kind of near where all this took place. And Nellie Knoll was an older lady, kind of think of the old creepy lady that lives in the you know, the rundown kind of apartment building that kind of gives away powwow advice. Anyway, she basically went and did a powwow on him where she put a dollar bill in Blymeyer's hand, removed the dollar bill, and in the palm of Blymeyer's hand appeared the face of a man. And she said the face of this man was Nelson Raymeyer, and he was the root of all your problems. He put some kind of curse on you. No one really knows why she picked out Nelson Raymeyer. It was kind of a strange thing because that once she pointed to Nelson Raymeyer, that kind of just set Blymeyer off because Blymeyer just wasn't really, he was easily influenced. He wasn't 100% all there upstairs. He probably had some mental issues that were undiagnosed. Nowadays, he probably would have been diagnosed. But back then, mental issues were something that they would just kind of throw you in a mental hospital and they wouldn't really look into it much further.
So this isn't something that you say in your film, but it was something that I was thinking as I was watching it. I mean, my guess is that Nellie Knoll was targeting Nelson Raymeyer in an effort to eliminate her competition.
You know, that's a very good theory. Why not? Sure, because she was one of the top dogs, but there were other people coming into play, and Raymeyer was a huge someone who was really kind of gaining steam in the powwow area. So yeah, that's a great point. Maybe that's exactly what she was trying to do, knowing Blymeyer was the type of guy that could maybe take it to the step she needed him to take it.
So she was called the Witch of Marietta, but the powwow practitioner you interview in your film does really make a distinction between witchcraft and powwow practice. Is there a difference?
There is a difference. I mean, really, powwow in its core is used to help people. There is really no witchcraft involved in powwow, but I guess the theory is once you know how to do these kind of charms and spells for good, you can flip it around and do them for bad. And that's kind of where witchcraft comes into play. Anytime you have the ability to help people, you know, using these kinds of charms and spells, the theory is that you also would then have the ability to hurt people as well.
So Nellie Knoll tells John Blymeyer that the cause of his trouble is Nelson Raymeyer. And Blymeyer, from that point on, is pretty much a ticking time bomb, obsessed with lifting this hex, doing whatever it takes to make it gone. But he was a slightly built man, and he realized right away that he'd need some help in overpowering Nelson, wouldn't you say?
Right. He thought he needed some help, and also I think he just wanted to get some other people involved. I think Blymeyer, in a way, was smarter than he appeared, even though we know he was mentally ill. I think he knew what he was doing, so he thought, well, let me get a few other people involved. It'll simply make it easier for me to get the things I need. Nellie Knoll told him that he needs a lock of Raymeyer's hair and his book of spells. He needs to bury the lock of hair 6 feet underground and burn the book of spells, and that will get rid of the curse. So yeah, to involve a couple other people to help him kind of get these items would have been a lot easier. So that's kind of how he roped in the two other fellows that helped him, John Curry and John Blymeyer, and Wilbert Hess.
Could you talk about these accomplices he enlists? Who were they and how did he meet them?
Again, so Blymeyer preys on people that are weak, that are weak-minded or young. Curry was a young kid. He was only, I believe, 14 years old. And he comes from a family where he was beat by his father a lot. So him and his mother moved up to York, the area in which Blymeyer lived. He worked with Blymeyer in a factory, and that's how they met. So basically, Curry told Blymeyer his story, and Blymeyer's like, well, you seem to have a lot of the same things going on that I do, and I was told I was cursed by this Nelson Raymeyer character. Maybe he has some kind of hold on you as well, so you might want to help me out, you know, getting these things that we need, and maybe both our lives will improve. So that was kind of how those two met. Wilbert Hess was part of the Hess family, and they had a farm. Milton Hess was his father, Ida Hess his grandmother. And these farms, the Ida Hess farm and the Milton Hess farm, are right next to each other. And one farm was doing really badly, and one farm was doing really well. Milton Hess farm was doing really poorly, and the Ida Hess farm was doing really well. So Milton just didn't understand why his farm was performing so poorly, and back in those times, instead of blaming anything, instead of blaming the weather or anything like that, you automatically go to some other place. So he went to the place of maybe someone has cursed us. Maybe someone is wishing ill against us. Some thought maybe it was Ida Hess, you know, the relative that was causing problems so she could get all the crop. But they ran into Bleymeyer, told the same story to him, and Bleymeyer knew that the Hess family had a car which could help them get down to where Raymeyer was. So that's kind of why he roped him into it.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906. When a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
So on November 26th, 1928, Bleymeyer went to the home of Alice Raymeyer, Nelson's wife. Can you talk about what happened during that first visit?
Right. So they basically went out looking for Nelson Raymeyer. It was really two of them on that first night. It was Curry and Bleymeyer. So they went over to Alice Raymeyer's house, who lived just over the hill from Nelson. Of course, she was living separately from him because of all the powwow. And they basically knocked on her door and said, "Look, we're looking for Nelson." She said, "Well, he's where he always is, in his house, you know, over the hill." She pointed him to his home, and they walked over to his house, knocked on the door. And Nelson, again, is a friendly guy. He thought maybe they were there for powwowing and said, "Hey, come on in. We'll chat." So they were invited in. They came in, and they were kind of scanning the room, kind of casing the scene, when they realized, you know, this guy's even bigger than we thought. Curry was 14. Bleymeyer, like you said, was a slight man, and he just thought, well, we're not going to be able to take him tonight. We're not going to be able to ask him for these items because he's probably going to be resistant. So let's just kind of case the area. Nelson said, "Why don't you stay the night?" They stayed the night. Friendly. Everything was fine. They stayed over. But the next morning was when they went over to the Hess farm, Milton Hess's farm, and said, "We're going to need one of your boys to come with us because we're going to need three men here." So that was when Milton Hess actually recruited his own son, Wilbert, to go along then the next evening to kind of do what they need to do and get the items they need to get.
So they go back the next day on November 27th. Tell us what happens on this visit.
So the three of them go down, knock on the door again, and Nelson answers, probably surprised they're back with now a third man. And basically Blymeyer's says, we left something from the previous night. And Nelson's like, well, I don't see anything you've left, but feel free to look around. And as they're doing that, Blymeyer basically frustrated turns to Nelson and is like, look, I need a lock of your hair and I need your book of spells. And Nelson's like, well, what are you talking about? He's like, well, I know what you've done. I need a lock of your hair and your book of spells. Look, we can take care of this real easily and we can get this over with. Nelson just didn't really understand what this guy was doing. So he was resistant. And Curry picked up a chunk of wood from the fireplace and smacked Nelson in the back of the head with it, dropped him to the ground, and a big fight ensued. And no one really knows exactly what went on inside that house. Even the court transcripts really vary. So it's kind of like all three of them kind of got in on this fight. We do know a rope was used and put around Nelson's neck at one point, and that rope was then tightened, and that was essentially what killed him. Also, there was a crack. The wood that hit him on the head supposedly ruptured something in his brain to also assist in killing him. It was really kind of accidental. I don't think it was really ever intended to kill him. I think they intended to just kind of knock him out, take the hair, find the book, and get out of there. But one thing led to another. The fight was probably around 60 seconds long. But once they realized we killed Nelson Raymeyer, we need to get rid of this evidence and we need to get out of here. So they tried to burn the body and hopefully burn the house down, but that didn't happen. That didn't work. So they lit him on fire. They left, but the fire quickly went out. No one really knows why. There were some theories that, you know, Nelson's practice of powwow and God helped do that, put out the flame. Another was he started to fall through the floor and there was a potato bin hanging in the basement below him that kind of held his body up and didn't allow the body to fall down through and light the basement on fire. So he was kind of, you know, the fire went out there on top. So there's theories of why he didn't burn up, but I would love to have been a fly in the wall when that fight took place, because, you know, there were some that said, oh, the fight lasted 30 minutes, 15 minutes, but really in the court transcripts, I think it's pretty clear when Wilbert Hess said the fight was about 60 seconds long.
So who discovered his body and how did the investigation begin?
One of his neighbors heard some of his animals, I believe a few horses, were kind of acting funny as if they haven't been fed or whatnot. And so they went and knocked on the door and didn't get an answer. And there's a couple of versions of who found him. One was the mailman found him, but I don't think there really would have been mail going at that time because I believe it was Thanksgiving. So I believe it was one of these neighbors went in and knocked on the door. And when he didn't answer, they opened the door and found him. And that's when they just called the police. And then the investigation begun. The investigation didn't take too long because since they went to his wife's house the night before, she was able to point to exactly, you know, who came to her house. They assumed, well, it must be these, it must be Blymeyer must be involved. And they rounded these guys up pretty quickly. They didn't really try to run. They kind of thought what they did was what needed to be done. So even when Blymeyer was arrested, he said, well, yeah, he put a curse on me. What was I supposed to do? I mean, that was his mentality. He being arrested and put in jail was not his biggest problem, because his biggest problem to him was solved.
I know you've mentioned this briefly already, but I'm intrigued about the fire and the theory behind how it went out. And you do go into it a bit in your film.
Yeah, his great-grandson in the movie who I talked to, basically his theory was, or he said, and I don't know if this is true, I had trouble kind of understanding what he meant by this, but what happened was Nelson's one leg started to, the floorboard started to burn away, and his one leg and the lower half of his body started to go through the floorboard. But under that floorboard was where Nelson would hang his potato bin. So the great-grandson, Ricky Ebal, says, he would have fallen through. The rest of his body kind of would have been pulled through the floorboard. But there's that potato bin, which, you know, potatoes have moisture in them. And he thought that the body kind of hung on top of that potato bin. And there was enough kind of moisture around the potatoes and things like that. It was damp in that basement that it outed the flame. I'm still having trouble wrapping my head around that. I think maybe they simply just didn't put enough kerosene oil on him. You know how hard it is to actually at times start a fire. And if you've ever been camping, it's not, you don't just like throw a match in some wood and it lights on fire. It's like you have to kind of build it. I think it was more just they didn't have enough fuel for that fire when they lit him up. The body's 75% water. I don't think, you know, it's easy to just burn a body. I think you need to have a lot of things to kind of help it along. So really, I just think they didn't have enough stuff there to, they just threw like a sheet on top of them. I think once that sheet burned through, there wasn't enough fuel there to keep the fire going.
So there was no question about who killed Nelson Ray Meyer. His wife Alice had directed John Blymeyer to her husband's house. And once Blymeyer was arrested, he freely confessed his involvement. Can you talk about his trial and how witchcraft was introduced by the attorneys?
Yeah, I'll do my best. So the way witchcraft got introduced into the trial, the judge didn't want any mention of witchcraft ever brought into this trial because obviously witchcraft is something that's a very polarizing subject. They just wanted simply the evidence. They didn't want to get into, like, you know, what witchcraft can do and things like that. It just isn't really anything concrete there. So they were trying to keep it out of the trial. But what happened was, I believe it was Wilbert Hess's brother that got put on the stand and was telling the judge, well, the reason that Wilbert got sent down to help Blymeyer was because they thought Raymeyer was a witch. And from that point forward, the media really took hold of that and started plastering all over the newspapers that, you know, they, Raymeyer was a witch, he was practicing witchcraft, blah, 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 or this, what these fellows thought. And that's kind of how witchcraft got introduced. And it kind of went on from there.
What was the verdict in Blymeyer's trial?
The Blymeyer verdict was guilty, life in prison was the initial verdict, first degree murder. So he got sent to Eastern State Penitentiary and went on from there.
So despite the fact that he got sympathy from the locals over his motivation, many in the community could relate to the fear of a curse, I'm sure, there was still no question that he was responsible for the murder and he needed to be punished.
There was no question, just also based on his history. He spent time in a mental institution, which he escaped from. I mean, there's so much in his backstory that to point that just, you know, he wasn't right in the head. And they tried to correct it with, you know, sending him to the mental institution, but that just wasn't enough. So people like that, you kind of, even his own family, you know, in the movie, you'll see when he gets actually released early from prison, he doesn't spend his whole life there. I can't remember off the top of my head how many years, I think it was like 24 or 25 years. And from that point forward, when he got out, his family wanted nothing to do with him. They didn't think he was right. They never really thought he was right. And they also thought he would do it again. And, he was a guy that just didn't have a lot of friends, rubbed people the wrong way. And I don't think there was any question that he needed to be punished for what he did.
So let's talk for a moment about John Curry's trial. The jury was pretty sympathetic to him because of his age. Is that fair to say?
It was very fair to say. I think he was, you know, he was a young kid. He looked up, you know, back in those days, not so much today, but back in those days, you know, you respected your elders, you looked up to your elders and you listened to them. So I think when an adult comes up to you and says, you know, this guy is doing this and I need your help, you're probably going to help that guy, especially if you worked with him and knew him. And he was just easily influenced. And that influence is what led him into the situation and what led him to help John Blymeyer. So, you know, I don't feel like he was 100% to blame. He was a young kid. I mean, you're 14 years old. I don't know if you remember when you were 14, but I feel like when I was 14, I listened to a lot of what an adult said to me. And he went along for the ride, and it was the wrong ride to go on.
And again, the purpose of these three men going into Nelson Reymeyer's house was not to murder him. Only one of the three struck the fatal blow. For Curry, it's almost about just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, right?
Very much like being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, they went down there with the intent of, hey, we're just going to, you know, subdue this man, get his scissors out or a knife, cut off a lock of his hair, get that book of spells and get out of there. That's all it was.
So how do things turn out for John Curry? What's the verdict and what happens to him?
So he got first degree murder as well and sentenced, I believe, to life in prison. But he also got out early. Again, none of these guys served their full term. So when John Curry got out, he actually ended up working for Eisenhower in the war because he was a really good map maker and he was a good artist. So he did artwork and things like that, and he actually helped draw up the plans for the invasion in Normandy on D-Day.
So what about Wilbur Hess? Could you just briefly talk about him and his trial and how things fared for him?
Yeah, so Wilbur Hess was the only person who had an attorney that they bought and paid for. The other two had, you know, public defenders. Wilbur Hess, they actually were able to get an attorney. And this attorney was really good. He was a really well-known attorney, and he had it all lined up where he was going to frame it as if Wilbur Hess was kind of the sacrificial lamb for his family to be sent down to the Hollow to help relieve this family of his curse. So he went down, not because he wanted to go down, but because his family picked him and sent him down there. So he didn't have a choice. And that was really how he framed the argument in his trial. Wilbur Hess was just trying to help his family. What a great thing. What a great service he was doing for his family to help get his their farm back on track and this and that. And I think there was a lot of sympathy toward him more than Curry that he was more of the sacrificial lamb. And because of that, he was the only one to get second degree murder and only sentenced to 10 years in prison. Although he ended up serving, he was the only one to serve his full term. He served the full 10 years and then got out after that.
And what about John Blymeyer? Do you have any information on him regarding his later years?
So the way Blymeyer lived out the remaining years of his life was he kind of worked as a janitor in a few different places. He obviously wasn't able to get any kind of real legitimate work after that fact. His family disowned him. He was really never talked to his family much after that point. And when he died, they were unable to even get his family to be pallbearers at his own funeral. They had to get people off the street to be pallbearers for the funeral. And he was just buried without much fanfare at all. So he was kind of just a forgotten member of the Blymeyer family from that point forward.
I want to touch on something briefly. Your film at one point shifts to an earlier murder of a girl named Gertrude Rudy. Why did you decide to include mention of her murder in your documentary?
The murder of Gertrude Rudy was a girl who was found dead on the railroad tracks. I think it was a year before the Reymeyer murder took place. And they were unable to find anybody accountable for it, but many people believe it was John Blymeyer who actually committed that murder because he was seen kind of having a tryst with this girl off and on before she was murdered. And supposedly he also took the shotgun of his father that was never returned to him. And a shotgun was used to kill the girl, which he then put on the railroad tracks, and hopefully a train would have run over her and kind of made her unrecognizable. But the train operator found the girl before that happened. And they could never, though, pin it on John Blymeyer, even though a lot of the evidence pointed to John Blymeyer. They weren't able to use that in the trial for Nelson Reymeyer, and they were never able to actually pin the murder onto Blymeyer. But many believe the year before the Reymeyer murder, he killed this girl, Gertrude Rudy, as well, which is also why I think it was a lot easier for him to commit murder with Nelson Reymeyer because he already did it once before.
One of the things that I enjoyed about your movie was that you were able to talk to relatives of each of the convicted murderers and of Nelson Reymeyer, the victim. And one of the more interesting interviews took place in Reymeyer's house, which is still standing, furnished, and it appeared to be unchanged from the time of the murder.
That's right. Yeah, we were able to get access to his house. It still stands today. It's not occupied at the moment, but Ricky Ebal, his great-grandson, owns the house, and he gave us he was very helpful in helping us make the movie. And yeah, we interviewed him on the porch of Nelson's house, actually.
And we're even able to see some of the original burnt floorboards.
The burnt floorboards are still there. He decided to keep it there and not replace that. He has a piece of plexiglass over that area where Nelson literally went through the floor. So it was kind of a weird thing to see, knowing that it happened all those years ago, and it's you can see it clear as day.
What were some of the difficulties and some of the joys you had making this documentary?
The difficulties were just, I think, getting enough material together in terms of things I could show other than people talking. Because back in 1928, we just didn't have a lot of photographs. You didn't have any kind of, like you would have now, any kind of news footage or things like that. And that was the most difficult thing, was finding photographs of the people that were, you know, that were good enough to use in the movie. So I would just scour eBay, and I would scour all the historical sites, and luckily I was able to get enough, I think, with then the newspaper articles that I was able to find a lot of, to kind of put everything together so it wasn't strictly talking heads, even though it is a talking heads movie, which isn't a bad thing, but I wanted to be able to kind of make it interesting visually as well, as much as I could. So that was the tricky part. But there's so much more fun to it, where I found a local artist who was actually a relative of Bleymeyer, who was an artist, and he actually kind of drew up some frames for me to use to kind of visually tell parts of the story. So it's kind of neat that in the movie, when you see the fight, the representation of the fight done with these kind of still pictures that we kind of put some movement to, it was drawn by a relative of Bleymeyer's. So that was really fun working with him and getting that all together, and just talking to all the people, like Jeanette Harvey, who is the oldest person I talked to, who actually knew Nelson Riemeyer personally as a child. It was really neat to hear her stories and things like that. So it was really fun and a pleasure. And making a movie is always hard, and there's always parts where you're going to really have trouble getting through certain areas of the production. But overall, I think I did it at my own pace. I did it how I wanted to do it. And I think I'm really proud that I was able to kind of capture this particular story on film for not only the people in the community who appreciate it, but just for people who just like true crime and like old stories like this, who can now learn about maybe a case they weren't really that familiar with.
So were you able to have a local screening? And were you able to see some of the reactions from the family members you interviewed?
Yes, we that was the first place we screened it, was in York County, Pennsylvania, which is where the trial took place. And we screened it at an old movie theater there. We had three screenings in one day. The screenings held about, 300 people at a pop, and we sold all of them out. And we also then sold DVDs at the screening, and the response was more than I could have ever hoped for. It was really neat to see the people I interviewed watch the movie for the first time, and their reactions, and just the reaction of people in the community were just really appreciative that I was honest about the story. I didn't really paint anyone in a light that wasn't what it was. I just kind of let the story be the story and not try to inject any of my own personal thoughts into it, because I wanted it to more be a documentation of what happened as opposed to a slant on what I think happened. So people were really appreciative of that, both sides of the family, the two different families. And it was a thrill to just show it to them first.
So where can people watch your documentary?
The best place to go is hexhollowmovie.com. That's HEXHOLLOW movie.com. And from that point, right on the front page, will be the different links where you can view the film. So you can watch it on iTunes, on Amazon, you can purchase a physical DVD. So there's various ways you can watch it. And Halloween, you'll be able to watch it on iTunes for 99 cents. So you'll be able to rent it. So it's a great deal. Definitely pick it up and leave us a review. We would love to hear what people think about it, especially people who aren't familiar with the story. Anybody who's not familiar with it, we'd love to hear what they thought. So any kind of comments are appreciated.
Shane Free, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
This has been the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobweb corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.